Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. In this lecture, I'm going to discuss statistical analysis and the identification and interpretation of patterns of association, which I told you in a previous lecture is one of the primary purposes of empirical models. Then in the next two required lectures, I'll introduce you to game theory, a powerful tool for developing theoretical models, and discuss the key assumptions of the most influential theories of international relations. At that point, we'll be ready to return to the puzzles I laid out in the first lecture. Now that I've given you a bit of a roadmap for the next few lectures, I'll ask you to turn to the first slide for this lecture. You'll see there that I've got three goals this time around. Before I can show you how to identify patterns of association, which I've already said is the main thing I want to accomplish with this lecture, I need to introduce some more terms and concepts. And then once I have shown you how statistical analysis can be used to identify patterns of association, I'm going to have to take some time to explain that we need to be really careful not to overinterpret patterns of association. I might sound at that point like I don't see much value in a tool I just spent a fair amount of time training you to use, but that's not the case. I think statistical analysis in particular, and empirical models in general, of whatever type, are incredibly important. I'm just going to clarify, at some length, why I said in the second lecture that simply knowing that a pattern exists isn't very useful. I told you then, and will tell you again this time, that if we're going to learn anything useful about the world, we really need both theoretical and empirical models. Okay, enough throat clearing. Turn to the second slide. In the optional lecture about probability, I told you what variables are and how they differ from constants. Now we need to talk about two different types of variables. This is a common point of confusion for students, so pay close attention. The dependent variable is the one whose variation we seek to explain. It is often denoted, that just means written as, lowercase y. The independent variables are those whose variation we think explains some of the variation in the dependent variable. So the dependent variable is the effect, and the independent variables are what we believe to be the causes. Though we don't know for sure that they are, and we're looking to see if there's in fact any relationship at all between them and the dependent variable. Which, incidentally, tells us less than we'd like, since showing that there's a relationship is nowhere near the same as showing that we were right about what causes what. More on that later. Independent variables are typically denoted x, and if we have more than one, we'll often write them as x1, x2, etc., as you saw in the lecture on probability. But don't worry too much about that. The notation isn't so important. I'm only telling you since you might see it elsewhere. You won't be tested on that. The difference between the two, conceptually, however, is very important, and you will be asked about that on the first take-home test. One of the things that tends to confuse students, understandably, is that the distinction between independent and dependent variables is context-dependent. Students often ask, what about some variable? Can that be a dependent variable, or does it have to be independent? And the problem is, that's not how it works. Any variable can serve either role, whereas constants can't serve either. It's just a matter of what question you're asking. If you want to know whether people who graduate from university earn more money, for example, then some measure of income will be your dependent variable and some measure of educational attainment your independent variable. If you want to know whether wealthy families are more likely to send their children to university in the first place, then a somewhat different measure of income, that of the parents, will be your independent variable and some measure of educational attainment your dependent variable. And the takeaway there isn't that subtle differences in how things are measured tell you the answer. Again, it's the question you're asking, which factor you're assuming to be in the driver's seat, so to speak. So let's take a different example. You might think that attitudes towards immigration drive partisan affiliation. So you could collect data on public opinion and check to see whether there is a pattern of association between responses to some question about immigration and support for UKIP, for example. But you might also think that party affiliation is more of an expression of group loyalty, and determined less by one's positions on the issues than the partisan affiliations of one's parents, friends, and neighbors, and everything else following from that. In that case, you might treat support for UKIP as the independent variable, and attitudes towards immigration as the dependent. You might even go so far as to say that each argument has merits, expecting party affiliation to reshape people's positions on issues they don't care much about, while their feelings about one or two key issues might explain which party they support in the first place. Incidentally, there's pretty good evidence for this. Chris Aiken of Princeton University found that when the culture wars rose to prominence in the U.S., and the two major parties started to differentiate themselves more clearly on social and moral issues the way they always had on traditional economic ones, women who found that the party they'd historically supported was converging on a position they didn't support regarding abortion, changed parties. But men who found themselves in a similar position changed their positions on abortion so that they could stay in lockstep with the party they'd always supported. The reason men and women reacted differently, according to Aiken, is that abortion is an important issue to most women, worth changing your party over, but it's not for most men who would want to remain attached to their party and just change their issue position if they had to do that. So, again, the question of whether a specific variable is independent or dependent can only be answered in the context of a specific bit of analysis. These are not fundamental properties of variables themselves. And, as I said, you will be asked about that, so if you tuned out just now, I'd suggest you to go back and listen again. Otherwise, let's move on. Turn to the next slide, where I introduce a few more terms. First, it's time I tell you what a pattern of association is, since you've now heard me use that phrase several times. It's something that's said to exist when we've demonstrated systematic covariation between two variables. Which, I suppose, doesn't really help you any, because now you're wondering what the heck that means. Fair enough. Two variables are said to covary if their values tend to change at the same time. If that only sometimes happens, if it's not reliable, then we're not talking about systematic covariation, though we may be talking about covariation. But if seeing one change allows us to be dang sure that the other will as well, then we've got systematic covariation. So, for example, height and gender, or rather biological sex, which is not the same, though there's no need to go into that right now, systematically covary. There are some very short men out there, and some very tall women, but on average, men are taller. If that generalization bothers you, incidentally, I respect your desire to avoid giving offense. I've found that no one is more opposed to political correctness than people who are fond of saying things that aren't any sort of correct, people who are mostly just demanding the right to be jerks. But I'd ask you to note that I didn't say men are smarter, they're not, or anything that carries with it any sort of value judgment, just that men are taller, on average, acknowledging that there are exceptions. And all of that is true. The pattern can run in either direction when we talk about a pattern of association. If observing an increase in X leads us to expect a decrease in Y, there's a negative pattern of association. But there's still an association. The only time we'd say there's no pattern is when increases in X do not reliably lead to any particular change in Y. The number of hours that I've been awake systematically covaries with the probability that I've got a cup of coffee in my hand. It starts out high, then decreases fairly steadily as the day goes on. The number of hours that I've been awake also systematically covaries with the probability that I've got an alcoholic beverage in front of me. That probability starts out low, I'm not so much of a lush that I grab a cold one the moment I roll out of bed, but it rises steadily as the day wears on. The number of hours I've been awake, however, has no relationship at all to the probability that I'm watching a European football match, because I never do. And don't expect that to change once I've been here a while. Sorry, not for me. That's, in order, a negative pattern of association, a positive pattern of association, and no pattern at all. Correlation is a term you'll probably hear a lot more than pattern of association, but it's actually just a narrower version of the exact same idea. That is, calculating the bivariate correlation coefficient, and there's more than one way to do that, between two variables, is the simplest way to determine whether there's a pattern of association. And for that reason, a lot of students learn how to do it, while relatively few, at least at the undergraduate level, learn the fancier methods. But when people say correlation does not imply causation, a phrase I myself use a lot, including later in this very lecture, what they're really saying is that a pattern of association, be it measured through bivariate correlation coefficients or some more sophisticated method, does not imply causation. Of course, that's a mouthful. Put simply, when you hear people refer to correlation, know that they probably mean pattern of association, even though technically that's just one means of establishing such. What exactly is causation, then? Well, as I've said on the slide, that's a particular form of association where X directly, though perhaps probabilistically, impacts Y, but not vice versa. In other words, if changes in X lead to changes in Y at least some of the time, but changes in Y do not themselves lead to changes in X, then X is causally related to Y. X exerts a causal impact on Y. X can, in some sense, be said to cause Y. That's what we really care about. If we didn't think there was a causal relationship between X and Y, we probably wouldn't be checking to see if there was a pattern of association. So the fact that the latter cannot establish the former is rather a big deal. More on that later. Let me just clarify what I mean by probabilistic causality before we move forward. Getting decapitated causes death. That's pretty obvious, right? So does smoking, but not in the same way. The link between smoking and lung cancer, one of, but not the only ways in which cigarettes can kill you, is probabilistic. By that, I mean smoking increases your odds of contracting a rare disease from very, very, very small to very small. For that reason, the guy who taught me the first stats class I ever took used to tell people who would ask how he could smoke if he understood statistics that he continued to smoke because he understood statistics. Obviously, that was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but the point he was making is that, yes, you'd be well advised to avoid accepting that increase. I'm not encouraging anyone to smoke any more than he was. But probabilistic causality is a bit different from the more deterministic kind. That's what I'm trying to explain here. Most smokers will not die of lung cancer, but something else, probably a heart attack. That doesn't mean that smoking doesn't cause lung cancer. It absolutely does, just not every time, or even close to every time. The point is, if someone says that X causes Y, they're not saying that the relationship is perfect. And I think most people get this on some intuitive level, because I've never heard anyone say that they don't believe smoking causes cancer just because most smokers die of something else, like a heart attack. But I have had students lose points on assignments or tests because they didn't think that we could say that X causes Y if other stuff also matters. Don't make that mistake. If I ask you a test question about whether some factor causes war or not, all I'm asking you is whether the presence or absence of that factor directly impacts the likelihood of war, if only by a modest amount. I am not asking whether other things also impact the likelihood of war. Of course they do. That's not very interesting. Okay, so how do we identify patterns of association? Well, that can get pretty complicated. As I've already said, there are some pretty advanced methods out there, and if you were PhD students, I'd tell you more about them. But for this module, there's no need to get into all that. The fourth slide gives you an idea of the basic logic behind all of the more advanced stuff. If X and Y are both binary, that is, there are only two categories, either a characteristic is present or it's not, either an event happened or it didn't, then we basically just want to know how often Y occurs when X is present, and how often Y occurs when X is absent. The more often that Y occurs in the presence of X, the more likely it is that there's a positive pattern of association between X and Y. The more often Y occurs in the absence of X, the more likely it is that there's a negative pattern of association between X and Y. Though, really, it's the difference between those two figures that matters. If Y happens a lot overall, but happens even more when X is present than when it is absent, then there's a positive pattern of association. If Y rarely happens, but does happen somewhat more often in the presence of X than its absence, that too means we've got a positive pattern of association. Again, it's the difference more than the absolute numbers. So, for example, between 1816 and 2001, at least one bilateral war had occurred in roughly 1% of directly contiguous dyads, but less than 0.01% of dyads that are not contiguous. Okay, for that to make any sense, I need to explain a few of those terms, which incidentally appear pretty frequently in international relations research. A bilateral war is a war that involves only two parties. If there's three or more, we call it a multilateral war. Dyads are units that consist of two of something. In this context, that would be states. Contiguity is a property possessed by things that are directly connected. So a contiguous dyad is a pair of states that are geographically connected. That is, they share a border. The U.S. and Canada comprise a contiguous dyad. The U.S. and Argentina do not. In other words, what I've told you here with this example is that countries that border one another have fought wars against one another far more often than countries that don't share borders. In neither case did wars occur very often. As I've already said, war is much rarer than people appreciate, thankfully so. But neighboring states do fight one another more often than other pairs of states, which is really only so surprising. If X and Y are not binary, but continuous, then the logic is similar, but we don't talk about how often, but rather how much. A positive pattern of association exists if higher values of X tend to be observed alongside higher values of Y, and a negative pattern if higher values of X tend to be observed alongside lower values of Y. So, for example, I looked at the total volume of trade for every pair of states in 2001 and found that, on average, every additional 100 miles separating their capital cities was associated with a decrease of roughly $10 million in total trade. Lots of things affect trade relations, some of which we'll discuss in subsequent lectures, and unsurprisingly, distance is one of them. States that are far apart don't tend to trade a lot, on average, though of course there are exceptions. Note, however, that I've just told you that geographic distance impacts both conflict and cooperation in the exact same way. States that are far apart simply don't tend to interact with one another very much, positively or negatively. Stated that way, it's perhaps obvious, but for this reason, it's easy to show that states who have come into conflict with one another recently tend to trade at higher rates than those that have never fought a war. That's not because a recent history of conflict causes more harmonious relations. It doesn't. It absolutely would not be appropriate to draw from this the conclusion that if we wish to increase future economic cooperation between states, we should encourage them to go to war right now in the present. This is why we have that phrase, correlation doesn't imply causation. We're going to talk more about that soon, but hopefully you're already starting to see the problem. And you should remember this particular example because it may or may not appear on the first take-home test. Hint, hint. The way scholars of international relations most often check for patterns of association is through regression analysis, or some variant thereof. What the heck is that? Magic, for all intents and purposes. Not really, of course, but you don't need to know what it is or how it works. Drop me an email if you'd like to, though. What you do need to know is how to interpret the results someone like me might produce by performing regression analysis. So turn to the next slide. You see there a table of the sort I'll often use to share results with you. This particular table isn't based on any analysis. It's just there so I can talk you through what to look for. I will, however, show you a real example in just a minute. In a table like this, the columns differentiate statistical models, separate analyses, in other words, typically of the same dependent variable. The only reason they are in the same table is to save space. It's really essential that you remember that the information in the middle column was obtained independently from the information in the rightmost column, because sometimes they tell very different stories. Each row concerns a different independent variable. The individual cells of the table then tell us what pattern of association was found between that particular independent variable and the dependent variable in whichever analysis the column refers to. I'll convey that information to you as simply as possible, using plus or minus signs to tell you the type of pattern, and asterisks to indicate associations that are statistically significant. That's a fancy term for patterns of association that are strong enough that we're confident something is going on. We still can't be sure what exactly, for reasons I've already alluded to and will discuss even more soon, but we can be fairly confident that we're not looking at white noise. Random chance alone will make it look like there are patterns of association between variables that have absolutely nothing to do with one another. The asterisks tell you that I've ruled that out. So, if the table you're looking at here was based on actual analysis, it would tell you that X1 was found to have a positive association with Y in the first model, but a negative association in the second model. That can happen. If X1 referred to whether the dyad experienced a war in the past 2 years, for example, and Y was the amount of trade between them in the current year, and X3 was whether the dyad is contiguous, this is exactly what we'd expect to see. That would tell us that overall, there's higher levels of trade between states that share a border, but once we account for the shared border, we then find levels of trade to be lower following a recent war. So again, we have to be careful interpreting these sorts of results. Note that blank cells tell us that a variable wasn't even included in the analysis. If I asked you what pattern of association between X3 and Y was found in the first model, and you answered none, you would be incorrect, because that answer implies that we looked for one and found that it didn't exist. But the point is, we didn't even look. If a variable was included in a model, there will always be a best guess at what sort of pattern exists. In some cases, we'll determine the evidence is too weak for it to really mean anything, and that's why the asterisks are so important. but there will always be a positive or negative sign. So, for example, X2 was included in the first model, where no significant pattern of association between it and Y was found, but it was not even included in the second model. That's an important distinction, and you should expect me to try to trick you with it very soon, like maybe in the very next in-class activity. Turn to the next slide. There, you see the results from actual analyses I performed. These aren't very interesting results, and they don't speak to either of the big puzzles I hope to tackle in this module, but they give you a sense of what regression results look like that isn't entirely hypothetical, like the table on the previous slide. I looked at the level of spending on the military for every country in the world in every year between 1946 and 2007. Specifically, the dependent variable in both models is military expenditures per capita. That's the total amount of money spent on the military divided by the total population, so that we're looking at relative rates of spending and thus making fair comparisons between Israel, a very militarized country with a relatively modest population, and Nigeria, which spends a fair amount of money on the military in absolute terms, but wasn't very militarized for most of the period covered by this data. The independent variables I've chosen to include, mostly for illustrative purposes, are energy consumption per capita, a crude but useful measure of economic development, and simple indicators for different blocks of time. What we find is that, regardless of whether we take into account temporal effects, countries with higher rates of energy consumption per capita also have higher rates of military expenditures per capita. That's not very surprising or informative, but my goal at the moment isn't to impart great wisdom about relative rates of military expenditure, just to get you used to interpreting tables of results. Let's move on to the final topic for this lecture. I've hinted at this a few times now, but it's worth spending some real time on. What you see on the seventh slide is a graph indicating the number of individuals in the U.S. diagnosed with autism, as well as the amount of organic food sold in the U.S. over the same time period, 1997 to 2009. The graph shows a striking correlation, but I don't want anyone to think I'm suggesting that autism is caused by eating organic food, because I'm not. Rather, I'm trying to drive home, yet again, the incredibly important point that correlation doesn't, by itself, tell us much of anything. Which is a point that I think a lot of people have a superficial appreciation for, at least after they've heard a few trite examples, and I've got more of those, don't worry, they're fun. But for all that people joke about how everyone knows this, the phrase correlation doesn't imply causation having become a bit of a cliche on the internet, it's still depressingly common for people to try to win an argument by pointing to graphs like this, or citing studies that found evidence of a pattern of association. American proponents of gun control, for example, will point out that countries with strict gun control laws have, on average, lower rates of gun violence. Or they'll point out the same pattern among American states. But the problem is that these countries differ from one another in many respects, as do the American states. It's entirely possible that gun control does, in fact, lower gun violence. I'm not saying that it doesn't. But one thing I know for sure is that you can't prove that it does by telling people that gun violence is less common in the UK than in the US, or that it's lower in Connecticut than Alabama. Because it's at least possible that something else accounts for both the differences in violence and in gun laws, and you at least need to rule that possibility out first before you can declare that you've proven your point. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't even bother to try. Okay, let's step back from gun control. I probably just offended some of you, and I don't even care that much about the topic. By which I really mean I don't feel I know enough about it to get into a serious debate. It does matter a great deal. I'm not trying to trivialize gun violence. It's a serious problem, in the US at least, and getting worse. Let's go back to some lighthearted examples. In the US, researchers have found a negative pattern of association between weekly sales of hot chocolate and the rate of petty crime. Does that mean that we should tell people that hot chocolate is a powerful deterrent that protects them from criminals? No, of course not. That pattern exists because people buy more hot chocolate when it's cold out, and incidentally, people are less inclined to stand on street corners and snatch purses when it's freezing. Both variables in this case are being caused by the weather. But if you don't account for that statistically, you absolutely will find a pattern of association between the two of them, because they do systematically covary, just not because the one has anything to do with the other. Similarly, every stupid health fad that has ever existed has at least some statistical evidence in support of it, because certain types of people are more likely to try everything the magazines tout, and those people are also more likely to do things that actually work. A great way of thinking about this is the purple pajamas theory of success. This is hypothetical, but sadly all too believable. Imagine that in the late 1980s, some quack child psychologist did a bunch of talk shows touting the idea that you should put your kids to sleep in purple pajamas, because purple is the color most associated with royalty, and it makes kids aspire to greatness. Suppose this became a real fad, and a bunch of middle and upper class parents went straight out and bought their kids new pajamas, while working class families either didn't catch the interviews on daytime talk shows because they're working two or three jobs, or decided they couldn't afford to buy their kids new pajamas just because some talking head said it might have an effect. What would happen? Well, if 25 years later, you looked at rates of graduation from uni or divorce, levels of debt, or whatever, for young adults, you'd find that those who were put to bed in purple pajamas 20-something years ago were doing better than those who weren't, on average. But you'd be measuring the effects of class, not of pajamas. That's easy enough to fix, though, right? Well, in some cases. One study found that people who brush their teeth have fewer heart attacks, and while the authors admitted that they had no idea why that might be, they nonetheless interpreted this pattern as causal. That's, nucking futz. If exercise is important to health, and no one doubts that it is, and if people who don't exercise enough are ashamed about that and so lie to researchers when asked how often they exercise, then researchers who compare the health outcomes of people who do a lot of everything they've been told might be good for them, including getting regular exercise, to those who don't, are going to find that self-reported levels of exercise don't account fully for the difference in health outcomes, and so we'll conclude that something else must explain that difference, at least in part, like how often they brush their teeth, or eat quinoa. But they haven't given enough credit to exercise, because they can't have, not if people lie. And you don't really doubt that they do, do you? One more example before I talk about how we deal with this problem, though you're not going to like my answer, because it isn't very optimistic. You might be thinking that even if correlation doesn't necessarily imply causation, the lack thereof has got to be pretty damning. That maybe it's necessary for causation, even if it's not sufficient. If so, you'd be wrong. You'd be in good company. I know a lot of smart people, people with PhDs, who make the same mistake. I'm not trying to embarrass you, just educate you. Turn to the 8th slide if you haven't already. There you'll find a thought experiment that shows how a pattern might fail to exist, even if there was, in fact, a causal relationship. The example I'm going to use here is peacekeeping, which we'll discuss again later in the module. Suppose, hypothetically, that 120 civil wars occurred over some amount of time. And suppose further that half of them gave way to what we might think of as a fragile peace. That is, the fighting stopped, but everyone feels like it could start up again at any time. That one of the sides only agreed to a ceasefire so they'd have time to rearm, or whatever. If nothing is done to stabilize things, we expect 2/3 of these cases to return to war in relatively short order. The other half, though, had a more definitive resolution. That's not necessarily a rosy scenario, because when I say a definitive resolution, that can mean one side was slaughtered and so couldn't go back to fighting if they wanted to, because they more or less don't exist. But sadly, that's often what it takes for us to be confident that violence won't break out again soon. But we needn't assume they were all that brutal. So let's just say that, left to themselves, we expect one-third of this second set of cases to go back to war. Now, for the sake of argument, assume that peacekeeping is always partially effective. By that, I mean, let's assume that the probability of another war occurring is always lower in the presence of a peacekeeping operation than it would be without one, but that it never drops all the way to zero. Let's assume that peacekeeping operations have a bigger effect when the situation is already pretty stable than when it's more volatile. As I've said on the slide, albeit in more technical notation than some of you might be comfortable with, that means that we're assuming that the probability of another war taking place after peacekeepers are sent in would be one-half what it used to be, cutting from two-thirds down to one-third, for the first set of countries, and one-fourth of what it would otherwise be for the second set of countries, cutting it from one-third to one-twelfth. Finally, suppose that the UN doesn't have enough resources to help everyone, and prefers to go where it's needed most. Let's take that to the extreme, just for the sake of argument, and assume that all 60 of the fragile peace countries get peacekeeping operations, while none of the other 60 do. When it says on the slide that PKO equals 1, that means a variable measuring whether a peacekeeping operation was sent to a country would take on a numerical value of 1, indicating that such an operation was indeed deployed. Similarly, PKO equals 0 would mean that no operation was sent. I wrote things this way partly to save space on the slide, and partly to show you how variables like that appear in datasets. What would happen under these assumptions? Well, since the baseline probability of war breaking out again for the second set of cases was one-third, and it's the baseline probability that matters, as none of them will have received peacekeeping operations, we'd expect one-third of them to go back to war. One-third of 60 is 20, so 20 new wars among the cases without peacekeeping. What about the other half? Their baseline probability was two-thirds, but we don't care about the baseline here, because all of these countries got peacekeepers. So we expect one-third of them to return to war as well. That's 20 new wars here too. In other words, if we just looked at the raw data, we'd see 20 new wars among the 60 countries that experienced peacekeeping, and 20 new wars among the 60 countries that didn't. That is, we'd see absolutely no correlation between the presence of peacekeeping operations and the likelihood of a country returning to war. And if we were naive enough to think that the absence of correlation implied the absence of causation, then we'd conclude that peacekeeping doesn't work, even though we've already assumed that it does. Does this thought experiment prove that peacekeeping works? Of course not. But it tells you something about how you'd go about proving that it doesn't, if that was in fact your goal. It tells you that you can't conclude something doesn't work just because there's no correlation between it and the outcome it's supposed to affect. Because even when there is a causal relationship, we won't always find a pattern of association when we look at the data. The point I've been trying to make is that we must always be concerned about the possibility that some third factor, Z, causes variation in both X and Y, thus creating a correlation between the two, even though the two of them have no effect on one another. Geographic proximity might both be the reason that some dyads were more likely than others to have fought a war recently, and also be the reason why they trade at higher rates currently. Cold weather might be both the reason that people buy hot chocolate, and why fewer purses are being snatched. Health consciousness might both be why some people brush their teeth religiously and eat quinoa, and why they are healthier. A fragile peace might both make return to war more likely and encourage the UN to send peacekeepers, and so on. This is a serious, serious issue, not just for students of international relations, but all of us as human beings. People in positions of authority are constantly trying to persuade you on the basis of what amounts to correlational evidence, and you'll be better at life if you don't automatically fall for it. So, how do you know when to believe them? When are causal interpretations, if not quite warranted, at least somewhat less ill-advised? Have I got anything to offer? Sort of. But that's honestly the best I can do. The best anyone can do. And if they tell you otherwise, you should check your pockets. I know that's a depressing answer. Really, I do. I've gotten in trouble with my fellow academics for speaking my mind on this topic. But it's the right one. One thing that helps a lot is the level of control afforded by the laboratory setting. We don't need to be concerned that our correlation is truly being driven by some third factor Z when we get to determine who is exposed to X and who not, because we can then make sure that nothing differs systematically between the two halves of the study. Some have gone as far to say that controlled experiments are the gold standard of causal inference. And while I understand the reason that ruffles some people's feathers, I think that's basically right. Unfortunately, we rarely have that option in international relations. If you want to know whether headache medicine works, sure, run a controlled experiment. Randomly give some people the real thing and others a sugar pill. Boom. Solid evidence, immune to the correlation doesn't imply causation critique. But try getting world leaders to let you decide how much they're going to spend on the military, or whether they're going to offer concessions in the midst of a crisis. And then tell them your decisions will be entirely random, so you can be sure no third factors got in the way of the results. Not gonna happen. Some of my colleagues think that these critiques apply to statistical analysis of large data sets, but not to in-depth analysis of individual cases. I'm not so sure. I'll happily grant that when you go into the archives reading formally classified documents or interview decision makers, you gain insights that aren't available in large data sets, and that might guard against erroneous inferences in some ways. But it hardly guarantees that you'll arrive at the objective truth about those cases, and it certainly doesn't solve the problem for those of us interested in generalizable explanations. I think, unfortunately, if you are interested in big general questions, like why there isn't more cooperation in the world or less conflict, then you're eventually going to have to look at big general data sets. Not necessarily instead of other types of evidence, but that's got to be part of the search, I think. You just have to be very careful about how you interpret the patterns you do or don't find among such data. As near as I can figure, the best we can do is acknowledge that we all come to the table with certain opinions, based largely on intuition, and do our best to revise those opinions based on logic and evidence. That means looking for contradictions in our views, by formalizing our arguments and tracing the necessary implications of our starting assumptions. That's something game theory is really good at, and we'll talk more about that soon. It also means looking at the evidence, yes, but being aware that there's often more than one way to interpret the same pattern, but also that not all of those ways are equally plausible. As I've said before, I think we need both theoretical and empirical models. Empirical models tell us what patterns exist in reality. Theoretical models help us interpret those patterns. If you don't have a clear theoretical argument identifying how X might exert a causal impact on Y, then you ought not read too much into the fact that there's a correlation between the two, like brushing your teeth and heart attacks. The authors could not identify a mechanism by which X could lead to Y. That should have given them pause. The other thing I'd say is that if a well-developed theoretical argument exists, that tells us how some third factor, Z, would produce a correlation between X and Y, even if X had no direct impact on Y, then you can't look at evidence of correlation between X and Y and take that as definitive proof in favor of some other argument which claims that X does exert a causal impact on Y, even if you really, really like that argument.